This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM and online at w2media.ca. It's the best news, headlines, and interviews from the past week's daily morning show, The Media Mornings, every weekday at 7 a.m. on Co-op Radio. We're also podcasting now on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca. And you can syndicate our content. Go to our website to find out more information on that. Now, on today's show for this week, we're going to be looking back on a few of the big events, one of which was the Federation of Canadian Municipalities meeting here, with 2,000 politicians from across the country gathered in Vancouver to discuss major national issues from infrastructure to housing. We'll also have on the show with us Stuart True from the Council of Canadians talking about international trade and the European Trade Agreement, or CETA, an interview about Newfoundland and Labrador. And on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, we'll speak with Sid Chow-Tan of the Chinese Canadian Council, and we'll hear more about the legacy of Tiananmen Square and dissent. Stay tuned for that. We'll be right back with today's news.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Yes, include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.com.
And now for our top news headlines. South of the border in the U.S., the National Security Agency is currently collecting the telephone records of millions of U.S. customers of Verizon, one of America's largest telecoms providers, under a top-secret court order issued in April. The order, a copy of which was obtained by The Guardian, requires Verizon on an ongoing daily basis to give NSA information on all telephone calls in its systems, both within the U.S. and the U.S. and other countries. The document shows for the first time that under the Obama administration, the communication records of millions of U.S. citizens are being collected indiscriminately and in bulk, regardless of whether they are suspected of any wrongdoing. The new revelation comes after The Guardian also reported that a United Nations human rights expert called on Tuesday for closer scrutiny of governor wiretapping efforts around the world, saying that most countries' laws don't properly protect free speech. The Obama administration is under fire after the Associated Press news service learned that the government had seized its phone records of more than 20 separate phone lines assigned to AP and its reporters, affecting more than 100 journalists. The records were secretly obtained by the Justice Department as it investigated the source of information leaks on a terrorism-related article. In federal news, a top story this week, Pamela Wallin has a lucrative life outside of politics where she's been entitled to roughly $1 million in fees and stock options for her role on corporate boards. This is the latest news to come out of the federal Senate expense scandal. Her travel expenses, more than $300,000, are about to be released in a forensic audit by Deloitte, should be due in the next few weeks. It is just the latest scandal after Senator Mike Duffy was revealed to have falsely claimed a second residence in order to claim almost $100,000 from taxpayers. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Prime Minister Stephen Harper suffered another blow as a Tory member of Parliament quit the Conservative caucus, decrying the party's lack of progress on open government. The Toronto Star reports that Alberta MP Brent Rathgaber made public his decision on Twitter, saying he'd informed the board of directors that he'd resign from the Conservative caucus. Quote, my decision to resign from the caucus is because of the government's lack of commitment to transparency and open government. He later told the National Post that the Conservative Party was almost unrecognizable from what it was. And Harper's office reacted quickly, saying he should resign his seat and have an election. Rathgeber's departure for the Tory caucus marks yet more bad news for Harper as the Prime Minister struggles with the Senate spending scandal that has already forced two senators from the Conservative ranks. But Rathgeber's decision could prove especially wounding for the Conservatives, as he has been taking aim at the very principles the Tories rode to power on, transparency and accountability. He made no secret of his unhappiness with the government's refusal to back his private member's bill, which was meant to shed more light on the salaries of federal bureaucrats. Now, in BC, a rally outside of Vancouver Courthouse on Wednesday saw leaders of Vancouver Island who patch a South First Nations band and 200 supporters gather to vocalize their opposition to a Canada-China Foreign Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement, or FIPA, signed last year between Prime Minister Stephen Harper and then-President Hu Jintao of China. The band is seeking an injunction on the grounds that before signing any international agreement that could affect treaty rights, the government has an obligation to consult First Nations. According to Mark Hume of the Globe and Mail, demonstrators waved placards that said, "Hello FIPA, goodbye democracy," and "Stop Harper." Brenda Sayers, a Hupachaseth representative at the rally, said she hopes a groundswell of Canadians will express opposition to the agreement and force the government to cancel the deal. Ms. Sayers believes the deal is lopsided because there is relatively little Canadian investment in China, but Chinese investors have put billions into Canadian resources. Ms. Sayers is worried about the effect of the deal on resources extraction. Quote, "This deal will pave the way for a massive natural resource buyout and allow foreign corporations to sue the Canadian government in secret tribunals." She said that her band was especially alarmed when it first read of the agreement, realizing that if someone didn't initiate a court challenge, the deal would soon be ratified. The federal court case filed at the beginning of this year has stopped the ratification of the deal and has allowed opponents more time to rally against it. Now, in Toronto, seconds before he was tackled and beaten by police and hit several times and arrested at Toronto's 2010 G20 protests, which saw the largest mass arrest in Canadian history, almost 1,000 people arrested, over 1,000 people, a Toronto man was making a poster referencing a popular episode of a 1990s TV show, The Court Heard, on Wednesday. The Toronto Star reports that Adam Nobody, a 30-year-old stagehand, testified at the trial of Toronto police officer he alleges used excessive force in arresting him. Constable Babak Andalib Gortani has pleaded not guilty to assault with a weapon. Nobody, like hundreds of others, went to the lawn of the Ontario Legislature on June 26th to check out the scene at the designated protest zone. At times, he verbally confronted police officers about some of their actions, which included police horses allegedly trampling over demonstrators and several beatings. However, he said at one point he was hit from behind as he was walking away. On the video, half a dozen police officers can be seen piled onto Nobody. One alleged to be Andalib Gortani is seen holding his baton with both arms and making a thrusting motion towards the man who is lying face down on the ground. A photograph of Nobody's bare torso was put into evidence and three welts can be seen on his side, below his rib cage, and on his hip. Meanwhile, in other Toronto news, a slim majority of Torontonians believe that a video of Mayor Rob Ford allegedly smoking crack cocaine does in fact exist, according to a poll this week. The Ipsos Reid poll, conducted on behalf of CTV and CP24, found that half of the respondents polled agreed with the mayor and his brother, Councillor Doug Ford, that the allegations are an example of the media's agenda against Ford. But of the 50%, 20% strongly agreed with the Ford brothers. However, of the half who do not believe Ford and believe he is lying, 30% strongly disagreed, while the remainder somewhat agreed. In fact, Ford's support remains high in Etobicoke, North York, and Scarborough, whereas downtown has little support for the mayor, who got most of his votes from the suburbs. The Toronto Star revealed 2 weeks ago that two reporters had viewed footage of the mayor appearing to smoke crack cocaine. Ford has said he does not smoke the drug and that there is no video, but did not respond to questions several weeks ago asking if he had ever smoked the drug. Meanwhile, over the past decade, the average price tag of new homes in Canada has almost doubled, and homeownership remains hindered by skyrocketing personal debt. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities, or FCM, met this week in Vancouver, and we'll be hearing from the national president of CUPE, Canada's largest union, about those meetings after the news. The TIE reports that the Federation of Canadian Municipalities Vice President and Vancouver City Councillor Raymond Louis has said that Ottawa has no choice but to assist cities and towns that are struggling to create affordable housing in the wake of the FCM meetings, which brought 2,000 politicians to Vancouver over the weekend. Mayor Robertson set a housing-focused tone for the weekend when he emerged from the Big City Mayor's Caucus pre-conference on May 30th, saying that cities were increasingly concerned not only about homelessness, but also the ability of residents to own their own houses. For over half of Vancouverites and many other Canadians, homeownership is simply not in the cards. The FCM has warned that 500,000 Canadians could lose their homes, with $1.7 billion in social housing transfers from Ottawa running out in the next 6 years. Now, in other federal news, this week the chief electoral officer told the Speaker of the House of Commons that two Manitoba Conservative MPs should be suspended from their posts because of questioned election expenses. Elections Canada auditors found problems with the returns of both MPs, says the Canadian Press, but both campaigns refused to make the changes demanded by the election officer. The Elections Act says that a member of Parliament who fails to make a correction requested by Elections Canada cannot continue to sit as an MP. The next step is up to the Commons Speaker, Andrew Scheer. The two MPs, Shelley Glover and James Bezan, say that they will go to court over what they call an erroneous interpretation by Elections Canada. They call the problem an accounting dispute between their campaigns and the federal body. Election expense troubles have already cost Prime Minister Stephen Harper a cabinet minister. Peter Penichew is Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs until it was revealed that his campaign had accepted thousands of dollars in ineligible contributions. Penichew resigned and then was defeated last month in a by-election. Meanwhile, last week, a court ruled that although election results in robocall ridings would not be overturned, there had been a systemic and widespread attempt at voter suppression targeted at non-conservative voters. Now, in policing news, the lawyer representing a former RCMP officer who claims that she was sexually harassed on the job says a proposed class action lawsuit could take years before it makes it to trial. Janet Merlot left the RCMP in 2010 after a 19-year career in the force. Hers is just the latest sexual harassment claim to hit the force as it plummets in popular ratings. The Canadian Press reports that she filed her lawsuit alleging years of name-calling, sexist pranks, and requests for sexual favors, and she wants to have the case certified as a class action. But the case is already bogged down by legal arguments, including a motion from the federal government to have the case thrown out because Merlot didn't file in time. Her lawyer says that roughly 300 current and former RCMP officers have approached him with stories of harassment. A hearing to determine whether to certify the case as a class action won't happen until at least December. Now in Turkey, police have fired tear gas and water cannons all week at crowds who joined mass demonstrations in Ankara as the government hit out at U.S. expressions of concern over its handling of demonstrations. The latest violence and days of angry protests erupted after thousands of union workers filled the central Kizilay Square in the Turkish capital on Wednesday, urging Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan to resign. Ambulances took away at least four people who collapsed as the gas blew into nearby restaurants. Meanwhile, AFP News reports that Erdogan's government earlier defended its democratic record after the United Nations, the U.S., and other countries voiced concerns over allegations of police brutality, in which two people have been killed in the 6 days of unrest, sparked by a plan to develop one of the only green spaces in the city. In Japan, radioactive water is leaking from a storage tank at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi plant, its operator says. Nuclear plant operator Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, said that the worker discovered the leak on Wednesday. But as the BBC reports, on Tuesday, only the day before, TEPCO also announced it had found radioactive cesium in groundwater around the plant. The same plant was damaged in an earthquake and tsunami in 2011 and has been hit by several leaks and power failures in recent months. Hundreds of huge water tanks have been constructed at the site to store contaminated water used to cool melted reactor cores. While the company said the leak was small, it follows an admission that groundwater around the plant is contaminated. Fishermen are concerned about the leaks, although the government has been playing them down, with TEPCO convincing local fishermen that it was safe for the company to start pumping groundwater from around the plant straight into the ocean. Now, in the United Kingdom, the UK government is set to apologize and pay compensation to those tortured during the Mau Mau anti-colonial uprising in Kenya in the 1950s. BBC reports that British Foreign Secretary William Hague is expected to announce compensation in the region of $20 million. More than 5,000 Kenyans say they were mistreated, many through torture, by then-British administration. The British fought a bitter battle with the Mau Mau insurgents, who were demanding land and an end to colonial rule. Victims have been fighting for compensation for a number of years. The Kenya Human Rights Commission says that 90,000 Kenyans were executed, tortured, or maimed by the British, and 160,000 people were detained in appalling conditions. And that's our news for this week on Media Mornings. We'll be back to hear about the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre from Sid Chow 10. Stay tuned. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca. We're also broadcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca. Now, our next interview will mark the 24th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in China, and our host, Erwin Ustindi, interviewed Sid Chow Tan, director of the Canadian Chinese Council, here on Media Mornings earlier this week.
Welcome, Sid Tan, to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sid, you're well-known for your redress work around Chinese head tax survivors and representing the families and an advocate for human rights in Canada, for Indigenous people's rights, for the human rights of all people. The situation in Tiananmen Square 24 years ago, of course, it wasn't just today we mark it, June 4th, as the critical day, but what were you doing 24 years ago on June 4th?
Well, we heard about it, and as you know, when it's June 4th in China, it's almost June 5th here, so it was a day late. But at that time, I was doing community television, and we heard it, and I was doing a show called Chinatown Today. And we were just horrified by it, and we heard about the candlelight vigil the next day, which was June 6th, you know, which came right after. And if recall going down to St. John's Shaughnessy Anglican Church, meeting a group of people there and walking on the candlelight vigil down to the People's Republic of China Consulate on Granville Street there. St. John Shaughnessy's on 29th in Granville. So it was quite a walk, and I got some footage of that, and I've been using it. And that's what I was doing 24 years ago, is just joining in the candlelight vigil that happened so spontaneously right after Tiananmen Square here in Vancouver.
And the situation, you know, when I think about years later when the NATO was bombing Serbia, and you know, it's another situation where the left in Vancouver was a little bit confused about how to react. You know, in one level, it was defensive about all the anti-communist experiences that we have here in Canada with the criticism of the left, and suddenly people are finding themselves looking at a government. A would-be state capitalist government or a communist state. You know, it's debatable that the form of communism in 1989 in China, some would call it state capitalism. But how did you feel, and what did you see in the community, in the left community, with support for the demands against the regime to stop the lockdowns, the arrests of student leaders, the murders? How did you feel, and what did you see within the community here, and what type of support did you receive?
In the initial at the vigil, there was tremendous support and the pouring out and coming together. And then after the sort of heated time, I think that a lot of the Chinese-Canadian community just basically reached for their wallets. the issue is that, you know, if we look at it for 24 years now, we are looking at a whole generation that has been born in that time. It's more than a generation, and we're still looking at the same issue, human rights, the quest for democracy, Tiananmen, horrific. But in many ways, it was kind of an opening of people wanting liberty, people wanting freedom, and that it was crushed in such a way, very atrocious. And you know, what's happening today is the same as before, but as far as the left or the right, I don't think it was either. I was just thinking that it was just a horrific thing for a government to do to its people.
Yeah, I mean, we're watching the same situation here in Turkey today, where there's two deaths, 1,000 or 1,300 in jail, very rigorous, and the president is claiming that the protesters are criminals or opposition activists trying to revisit the election, and talking about social media as an illness. And it's interesting, those are probably similar, although Twitter wasn't alive in 1989, but I imagine the Chinese government was also making claims around how the demands of the students were unsustainable and unrealistic.
Well, the government is the government. The governments are always going to spin whatever line they're going to do, whether it's the Canadian government or the PRC government. I think... When you look at this, the important thing is that a people actually rose in the way it was so brutally crushed, and where we are today, 24 years later, it doesn't look like any progress has been made along the line of democracy and freedom. You have Lin Xiaobao, who a Nobel Prize laureate, who is languishing in jail. You have Ai Weiwei, internationally famous artist who is being persecuted. It's just atrocious. And, you know, while comments that I am making would be seen by the communist government, the one-party totalitarian state, as being messing in its internal affairs, which is the usual line, in fact, the internal affairs, why are mainland Chinese people coming to Canada and emigrating in such a way? Why are these things still going on? And it seems really quite clear to me is that it's freedom. It's the quest for freedom, the quest for liberty. And it is so inspiring to see Tiananmen still being remembered the way it is. And in fact, it's really quite a flashpoint, I think, that when you look at the government of the People's Republic of China, it will be judged by Tiananmen Square.
I remember being a photojournalist, probably one of the few in Beijing during martial law shortly thereafter, and it was quite an intense experience for me. And then I went to Hong Kong, and I could see how profoundly different life was in Beijing and in Hong Kong at the time.
Well, I think that at the time, 1989, getting, you know, I don't know what it was like there, but here, if you notice that the Chinese Canadian National Council, of which I've been national chairman for the past 6 years, in 1989, when this happened, it stranded a lot of students and academics in Canada that were Chinese nationals that were here studying or teaching, and also a number of people claimed refugee status for fear of going back to China and being persecuted for their ideas on democracy and freedom. And we actually took up the cause to have refugee status and settlement quickly for those that were stranded here in Canada because of Tiananmen Square. So that was another thing that sort of came out of it. And a lot of those students and a lot of those academics that were stranded are making great contributions to Canada now.
And we're last question going out to you, Sid. Just before, because we want to transition this over to the other story that you're providing today. What are the lessons, you think, for how we understand human rights issues globally? And do you think that we've learned, you know, I mentioned that comment about Serbia and the challenges of how the Serbs were dealing with Kosovo. And how do you think communities in Vancouver are dealing with these human rights issues when we see them across the world?
Well, I think that because Canada is an immigrant settler society, and various communities develop at different paces, and we have connections to, you know, what were sort of heritage countries. There's always going to be a bit of concern, but, you know, I mean, the one thing that we look at, we can fault the People's Republic of China for its human rights record, or Turkey, or a number of these places, but you know, our record in Canada, for what it's worth, is not that either. So, you know, in many ways, you've got to clean up your house before you start cleaning other people's houses, too. That's the way I look at it in terms of human rights, because there are... I mean, look at the situation of our indigenous people, you know, and the issue of human rights there. Look at the human rights of our temporary foreign workers. Look at the human rights of our nannies and the way that economic development or trade and all these things such as economies seem to dominate, you know, our world now, our consumer culture. And I think human rights is something worth standing up for and keeping strong, because, you know, we all live in a society which is a balance between collective and individual rights, and central to those individual rights are human rights.
And that was Sid Chow-Tan, director of the Chinese-Canadian National Council. We're going to go to an interview now with Paul Moist. He is the national president of CUPE, Canada's largest union. And he was out here in Vancouver for the meeting of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. Here he is interviewed earlier this week by Derek O'Keefe.
Upwards of 2,000 politicians and other interested parties in Vancouver for FCM 2013. Rob Ford is not here. I was looking at the agenda, and there is a big city mayor's caucus, so this is municipal politicians from throughout the country. But I did ask around as the conference was getting set up, and I was assured by multiple people that Rob Ford is not interested in FCM. CUPE is a public sector union whose members do a lot of the work in Canadian cities, including here in Vancouver, and we're very pleased to have on the line with us early this morning Paul Moist, who is the national president of CUPE. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling in here and telling us a little bit about your union's interest in FCM. So tell us what your agenda looks like for this weekend.
Well, CUPE, as you said, is the largest union in Canada. About a quarter of our members, we have just over 600,000, over 150,000 members work for towns and cities, including the city of Vancouver. And so the FCM is a annual event for us. As you say, upwards of 2,000 mayors and councillors from across Canada. And we'll be here meeting with a lot of these folks. They're our employers, and I expect this weekend there to be a tremendous focus on infrastructure. We may well hear comments about the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement, the Canada-European trade talks, which can deal with municipal procurement, and there's a number of municipalities concerned with that. And I'm sure we'll hear about there's federal party officials coming here from the Conservatives, the NDP, Liberals, and Green parties. So it's kind of a weekend of quiet lobbying for us, and on Monday we'll sponsor a forum for all councillors interested in attending on local partnerships, and we'll get into some discussion about how does one fund and conduct infrastructure renewal in Canada.
Yeah, I'm interested in this. I know that I remember when Jack Layton was the head of FCM briefly before he went into federal politics. There was a big push from FCM at that time to demand greater federal infrastructure funding for transit projects. Is this sort of something that just is not seen as possible with the current Harper government, not something they're interested in doing, or is this still a key point to demand a federal money to help with transit infrastructure? I know that's not necessarily what the area that your members work in, transit projects, but... you know, it's a huge problem here. Fares continue to go up on the system, and it just doesn't serve everyone who needs to get into the city for work.
Mm-hmm. I'm positive we're going to hear a lot about transit this week. The Premier of Ontario, the new Premier of Ontario, has got a multi-billion-dollar game plan to break the gridlock in the Greater Toronto Area. And as you say, there are multiple transportation issues here in the Lower Mainland. So I expect we'll hear a lot about that. I did serve, and I continue to serve, on an infrastructure task force of the FCM. There's some councillors. Raymond Louis is on there from Vancouver. And industry stakeholders, and CUPE's got one spot on there. And we did meet with the federal government over the last year, and there were some incremental moves in the recent federal budget, but it's, I think we'll hear this week, it's not enough. The FCM talks about a $123 billion infrastructure deficit. And what is that? Bridges, water, wastewater systems, transportation systems. The municipal property tax base across Canada, including here in Vancouver, cannot pay exclusively for the renewal of this infrastructure. And you really need three parties at the table, the municipality, the province, and the federal government. And, you know, I would think it's challenging times for towns and cities right now, because we've got a federal government kind of pursuing the austerity, pay down the deficit. So there wasn't much in the recent federal budget, and I'll be expecting to hear a lot about transportation and overall infrastructure funding. How does one pay for this deficit? We could give future generations of kids balanced books in a budget sense, and infrastructure that's falling apart, and nobody thinks that's a good idea.
Yeah, and that's maybe a good point to turn to provincial politics. I don't know how closely you followed it, but a lot of people here in British Columbia are still quite in shock from the results of the election 2 weeks ago. Christy Clark re-elected, and she was elected on this campaign pledge of a debt-free BC. Many analysts have said this, her promises of being debt-free in 10, 15 years are based entirely on unrealistic projections of LNG revenues from gas exports. Assuming that this windfall from LNG doesn't come in, we can project that the Christy Clark government will need to be making cuts, perhaps in the public service, perhaps against public sector unions. How much are your members here in BC and your affiliates here in BC concerned about the provincial situation?
Well, we have right now, most immediately, we've got over 25,000 K-12 employees who are without a collective agreement, and Premier Clark seems focused on teachers and talk of a 10-year deal. But that's a major round of bargaining for us, and in September we'll again be out in full force at the Union of BC Municipalities. They too, I'm sure, will have a list of demands for the Premier, and I would caution her about royalties from revenues from royalties of natural gas. You look next door in Alberta, and what was supposed to be a balanced budget situation has a multi-billion-dollar hole in it because of the price of oil. And there's a real detriment to putting all your eggs in the resource basket in terms of revenues. And so Premier Clark has a new mandate for 4 years, and I'm sure there's a whole bunch of requests for meetings to talk about transportation gridlock in the Lower Mainland and infrastructure needs. So we do watch this very, very closely, and I share your surprise about the result of 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. We have had a number of interviews debriefing that election, and a lot of people are still trying to figure out what happened and what the implications are for future political campaigns. Certainly a lot of assessment going on in the NDP camp. We are in Vancouver, Paul, so as you know, this is the home of the Fraser Institute, an influential right-wing think tank, quote-unquote. You mentioned infrastructure and public spending. They've just released a study advocating more public-private partnerships as a key to rebuilding Canada's infrastructure, roads, bridges, railways, other transportation projects. We have seen mega projects here in Vancouver done as P3s. We think of the Canada Line that went in a few years ago, a multi-billion-dollar P3. What does CUPE say about P3s, and what would you say to this Fraser Institute study that they're pushing right now?
Well, just on the overall question, we separate out, you know, who builds this infrastructure. That's a private sector job, and tendering and leasing that, you know, to the private sector is the appropriate historical thing. The recent fixation on public-private partnerships, almost all commentators, including the Fraser Institute, will say the devil's in the details. Number two, the public sector, at times of historically low interest rates, like we're in right now, can borrow money much cheaper. So if there isn't a lot of synergy or other justification for it, One needs to be careful about mortgaging debt. So we're talking the financing of it and the control of the infrastructure. Most citizens, including most municipalities in BC, do not want to give up control over a wastewater treatment or a water treatment plant, number one. Number two, the secrecy around many T3s. There's a former premier in Ontario right now who's no longer in public office because of a multi-million dollar boondoggle with two gas plants in Mississauga and Oakville. And we're paying up to $600 million to get out of these T3 deals. And that brought down the premier of Ontario, in my view. And we look at Mr. Harper's friend, Arthur Porter, the McGill Teaching Hospital. That's caused the new Quebec government to put a moratorium on T3s, multi-million dollar, I'll call it a boondoggle in Montreal. Mr. Porter's under arrest right now in Panama on his way back to Canada.
Well, he's fighting extradition now, so we don't know if he will come back to Canada.
Oh, okay. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, he's announced actually he's retained a lawyer who, believe it or not, used to assist in money laundering for Manuel Noriega's cocaine trafficking. That's all reported in the National Post today, so you can believe it. But
just as a footnote, pretty interesting. He was the head of CSIS as appointed by Mr. Harper, but
it's pretty surreal. But you're right; these are connected to the P3 issues. And the SkyTrain line I mentioned here in Vancouver was also built by SNC-Lavalin, which is the company that is accused of paying bribes, essentially, to Arthur Porter and others with this Montreal hospital project.
If I'm to believe the media, SNC-Lavalin was trying to hire Gaddafi's son to acquire work for them in North Africa. So back to the Fraser Institute. The Fraser Institute has drank the Kool-Aid that all things private are better than all things public. We know there's a lot of secrecy around P3s. We know when we do, and it takes a lot of work through access to information, and CUPE's gone to court over certain P3s simply to acquire the information that some of the numbers don't add up. So, again, our industry forum that we're going to sponsor here Monday morning here in Vancouver, if it's anything like the forum we sponsored last year at the FCM, it'll be well attended. And we think there needs to be a debate. There needs to be a debate about transparency around P3s, number one. And number two, ownership and operation of things like public transportation. Many Canadians think, okay, the private sector builds it and they have a right to make a profit. I agree with that personally. But who should own and operate the SkyTrain system? Who should own and operate a water treatment plant? This is very much contested terrain in Canada. And CUPE's locked horns with the Fraser Institute on many issues, and I think it'll continue on the P3 debate.
Well, excellent. And I would say maybe the Fraser Institute is serving some of that free market Kool-Aid, but not to editorialize here too much. Paul, we really appreciate you taking the time this morning.
And that was Paul Moyse, National President of CUPE, the largest union in Canada, interviewed by Derek O'Keefe on our program last Friday. We're going to go to a song now. This is Juno-nominated and Juno-winning singer and songwriter Kenny Starr. Her song off of our upcoming album, Kiss It. This song is called Home Is Everywhere. We actually premiered this song on our program a few months ago. Here's Kenny Starr. We'll be back with an exclusive interview with her about her move to Vancouver, body image, and a new National Film Board project that she's working on. Here's Home Is Everywhere. That was Home Is Everywhere by Canadian artist Kinney Starr. Here's an interview that I did yesterday with Kinney Starr. It's been a while since we chatted last, in December, I think.
Oh, wow.
And you were just launching your album fundraising campaign on Indiegogo. But yes. The album, is it out yet? Where is it?
August 11th. I'm also working on a film with the National Film Board of Canada. And also, you know, in the middle of a move and got some shows coming up. And so there's kind of a lot of projects intersecting. So it is sort of hard to keep track of.
Could you talk about your film board movie?
Well, the movie is, it's a collaborative. Connie Littlefield, who is a well-established director, she did a movie called Hoffman's Potion, which looks at the medicinal uses of LSD. In emotional, like before Timothy Leary popularized it, and how it was used in emotional counseling and stuff like that. So she's looked at the criminalization of like marijuana users, and she's sort of an out of the box thinker. And so her and I are writing this film. Well, we've been researching it and writing it for a year, and we'll be going into filming it soon. And the film is looking at. Well, our research base has been looking at when pornography became fully integrated with popular culture that we know today, specifically video culture. So we've researched when porn directors started directing music videos like Mandy Moore and Jessica Simpson, how that language became so dominant that we, you know, nowadays we see like video first, music second, kind of. And for women, videos in a lot of form follow a lot of the conventional narratives of porn, suggestively touching yourself, false eyelashes, long nail extensions, masturbating on camera, like all of those things that we understand as part of porn. They've really kind of sideswiped us, and they're in our video culture now and all of our marketing. And we all know sexism is alive and well, but it's been a really fun study and really also depressing to know how deeply coded musical language is now in, well, basically like Larry Flint and Snoop Dogg made doggy style feature length porn for music in 2001. And since then, it's like kind of the floodgates opened. So
we blame Snoop Lion for the advent of this this culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of reasons why pornography exists in full form, and why the internet and porn go together. I mean, it's like people like to look at naked chicks. We all get that, but what we're doing is for the filming part is we are interviewing women who are self-made, so women who have rejected those conventions, and that's going to be really fun. You know, because even if you look at, say, an old Alanis Morissette video and then a Rihanna video today, you can see a real difference in the way body language is used. Like, you know, that you ought to know. That video is like her in the desert. And she's fully clothed, and it's like the scenery is part of the story. And videos nowadays for women, a lot of videos are the reduction of body, you know, the body into body parts, and how hot can you look, how much can you shake your ass, how low can you dance.
So it's not about being naked or being sexy, though, because I mean, Alanis Morissette herself did that naked video,
exactly,
for instance, but that it wasn't, as you said, breaking it down into objectifying.
Yeah, like I think what's interesting in this discussion and what I'm fascinated by is that, you know, what is the difference between empowered body language and, you know, nudity as an empowerment tool, and then coded body language and the conventions of adhering to the male gaze. So those are my interests in this subject, because I certainly don't have the answers, and I'm criticized heavily for using nudity, like on the cover of my new record. It's my naked ass holding my grandpa's gun. And so people are like, well, how can you say you don't adhere to those standards when you're doing this? And it's a really good question, and it's a study of mine. I'm like, because I know what I feel when I see an image that makes me feel strong of a woman naked or clothed or whatever, or a man. I know when something makes me feel strong, and I know when something makes me feel ill, and it's different for everybody. So it's a pretty ongoing discussion. But for the purpose of the movie, we are going to be interviewing NFB came to me and wanted to make a Kinney Star documentary, and I was like, no thanks, I don't really want my family and me like pulled apart on film, but I'd like to interview other women. So that's what we're doing.
Who are some of the people that you're talking to?
We're talking to Jan Arden has agreed, Tegan and Sarah, Buffy St. Marie, Mishi Mi, Zaki Ibrahim, Serena Ryder, Carol Pope. We've still got a maybe with Joni Mitchell. Alanis Morissette said no. I think I may have named them all.
You've just listed pretty much the best women in Canadian music.
Yeah, it's going to be so exciting for me because a lot of these women are women that really have inspired me, even if they've come up at the same time as me. Like Tegan and Sarah started a year later, but I can't wait to pick the brains of all these women.
You got your first concert since you moved to Vancouver on Saturday. What's it like to actually be back in this town that you lived in quite a few years ago, and now you're performing here again with a few other amazing musicians like Kaitami?
Yeah. Well, I always get nervous before shows, so I'm already nervous, and the show's only like 3 days away, and I'm already like anxiety dreams and stuff. But I realized, you know, in the last few years that I was away and out in Ontario taking care of my dad and being with my family, I realized that everywhere is good and everywhere is what you make it. But Vancouver, I don't know, I like the trees. I just have to say, I like those massive trees. They're everywhere. I like the ocean. I like the forest. So it's making me feel a little bit nervous because I feel like I owe something to this city.
And that was Kinney Star, interviewed on Media Mornings. Our final interview today is going to be with Stuart True with the Council of Canadians on a project in Newfoundland and Labrador that could come under fire from the Canada-Europe Free Trade Agreement. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here in Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca, and now podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca. Our final interview is with Stuart True, the trade campaigner with the Council of Canadians, interviewed earlier this week by Jane Bowie.
It has been revealed that federal funding for a hydro project in Newfoundland and Labrador was tied to the province removing minimum processing rules in the fisheries. That was revealed by the Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, and the Council of Canadians is demanding to know what other provinces are being bullied by the Harper Conservatives into accepting unfavorable conditions in the Canada-European trade deal. On the line, we have trade campaigner for the Council of Canadians, Stuart True. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Jane.
And how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Very well. So I understand that you're also now calling for Newfoundland and Labrador to formally pull out of CETA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So can you tell us whether the news reports and the details of that news report and whether it came as a surprise to you?
Sure thing. It's actually quite remarkable what's gone on in Newfoundland and Labrador in the past week with the CETA negotiations. So the Premier, Dunderdale, has made a few statements that are quite shocking. One of them, of course, is, as you said at the top, that the federal government was essentially bribing them to try and support the EU trade deal, to try and get rid of local processing rules on fisheries. So these are rules where fish caught in Newfoundland waters has to be processed to different degrees depending on the fish, has to be processed in the province. And so that, of course, creates jobs. It allows you to manage the fisheries a little more sustainably. The alternative, of course, is letting big multinational European, for example, ships come in and just scoop up what they need and take it somewhere else for processing. That could be in Europe or it could be in China. Increasingly, a lot of processing happens in China. So this is a very controversial issue in Newfoundland and Labrador. There's already been some decisions related to one company that wanted to process in China. And so the Premier said, we're not willing to make that change. And apparently Nigel Wright, Harper's former staff, had called up the Premier last year, and essentially said, well, the money that we will offer you for the Muskrat Falls Power Project will be conditional on you giving up those local processing requirements for fish. This threat or bribe or whatever was made again, apparently, by the trade minister, Ed Fast, on a subsequent trip to Newfoundland.
Wow.
So here we have them, you know, stuff we kind of thought had been happening in the background for some time. But, of course, with so much in the CETA negotiations, the EU trade negotiations, it's all kind of hush-hush and secretive. But now we have this proof that the government is pulling these bribes or threats out of its pocket, trying to buy off the provinces. And so we do have the question of, you know, what has Christy Clark, for example, promised the Harper government, or what has she been promised in exchange for her support for this trade deal?
So, I mean, as you said, it was the sort of thing that you were suspecting was happening in the back rooms, but I imagine it still was a bit of a shock to find out the full extent of what was going on.
It was, and in fact, when I said at the top, it gets worse. I mean, subsequent to explaining what had been going on there with Muskrat Falls and the kind of quid pro quo there, Premier Dunderdale said, in fact, they have proof that the federal government has been leaking to the Europeans the Newfoundland government's negotiating position on a number of areas, so not just fisheries, but here's where Newfoundland is willing to go on these areas, basically giving up Canada's position or Newfoundland's position to the European negotiators, and then asking or giving permission to the EU or perhaps EU multinational companies to start a concerted lobbying effort to pressure the province of Newfoundland to give up more than what they were planning to give up in the negotiations.
Oh, wow.
Here we have complete bad faith on behalf of the federal government. I think it's the federal government. It's proof that the feds are actually negotiating on behalf of European multinationals in this trade talk. And that's a concern we've also had from the beginning, that there was very little chance that Canada would get a good deal out of CETA, the EU trade deal, simply because of who we've got negotiating for us.
And that was Stuart Trouk, Council of Canadians trade campaigner, interviewed by Jane Bowie. That's our program for this week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca and on Rabble Podcast Network.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news, from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maud Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at W2Media.ca.